Good evening, everyone. It is a great pleasure for me to welcome our speaker this evening, Dr. Laili Uddin. Laili is an historian of 20th century South Asia and has worked extensively on the history of former East Pakistan, the region that is now present-day Bangladesh. In particular, Laili is already quite widely known among South Asianists for her path-breaking doctoral research on one of East Pakistan's most charismatic political leaders, Maulana Bhashani. Laili has had a distinguished academic trajectory. She did her undergraduate studies at the London School of Economics, a master's degree at Oxford, a second master's at Harvard. Laili then did her doctoral research at Royal Holloway, University of London, and worked under the supervision of Professor Francis Robinson. Her doctoral dissertation was entitled In the Land of Eternal Eid, Maulana Bhashani and the Political Mobilization of Peasants and Lower Class Urban Workers in East Pakistan, circa 1930s to 71. In 2016, her dissertation was shortlisted for the S.S. Pirzada Dissertation Prize, awarded at the University of California, Berkeley, for the best dissertation in Pakistan. Her dissertation was so tremendously impressive that even though the prize went to someone else, the judges were compelled to create a new category called special mention to recognize the brilliance and originality of Laili's doctoral research. In 2018, again, this dissertation was shortlisted for the Braze de Gruyter Prize in the Study of Islam and the Muslim World. But much before these distinguished institutions recognized the brilliance of Laili's work, someone called Amitav Ghosh had already gauged the significance of her research. After I first met Laili, like any self-respecting person of the 21st century, I stalked her online by googling her name. And the first thing that popped up was a blog entry by Amitav Ghosh excitedly describing his meeting with Laili at the British Library and their conversation about the charismatic leftist Sufi leader Maulana Bhashani, whom Ghosh had met in his childhood. Indeed, Laili's work has also been recognized by a large group of contemporary followers of Bhashani, both in Bangladesh and the wider Bangladeshi diaspora. One of the things that makes the reach of Laili's work so widespread is her keen attention to language. Laili works with 6 research languages, Bengali, Sylheti, Assamese, Hindi, Urdu, and Farsi. It will come as no surprise that she was hired by the British Library as a curator for a major EHRC-funded project called 2 Centuries of Indian Print. Laili then went on to do briefly a teaching assignment in Pakistan at the prestigious Lums University in Lahore. And now Laili has won both a Leverhulme Fellowship based at King's College London, where she starts next month, and an ERC grant based at the University of Cambridge, which starts subsequently. As you can tell, introducing Laili is an exercise in being bedazzled. It is therefore very, very exciting for us to have her present here, present her research here at Cambridge today. I give you Dr. Laili Uddin.
That was all rather embarrassing, but I'm very thankful for it. Thank you. I would like to thank the director of the center for inviting me to what appears to be an excellent series on global Islam, to Barbara for sorting out the logistics, Paul for chairing this event, and to the audience for humoring me with your presence. I hope not to disappoint you today. But let me warn you that this is a very old paper in some ways, and I feel like I've been working on this paper for ages, but it's never quite finished. You know, new ideas and thoughts keep making their way into the paper, so I apologize for burdening you with my burdens, but I'd be very grateful for the feedback. In some ways, my work and this paper has been heavily influenced by Gary Wilder's excellent work on the Negritude movement, in particular his ideas of opening and foreclosure, which I think is most apt for describing radical left politics, imaginings and futures in post-independent South Asia, where we have seen a recurring politics of openings and foreclosure, an opening of ideas, practices, solidarities and futures deeply political, imminent, real and anticipated, but cut short often brutally by those who don't really understand what it means to toil physically, emotionally or imaginatively. The use of labor is specific here, for today the paper will speak of radical political imaginaries and practices centered upon and located within poor, rural and working class constituencies and their existence in what used to be a united Pakistan. So let me begin. On the 17th of March 1969, On Monday evening, a crowd gathered at a Maidan in Kherpur, Sindh, to hear Maulana Jan Muhammad Abbasi, who was the Amir, the leader of the Jamaat-e-Islami, the main Islamist party in Pakistan, to hear him deliver a speech against socialism. He had barely begun the speech before it was interrupted by a stampede of cows. The crowd scattered, leaving behind shoes, hats, and other belongings. As the crowd tripped, stumbled, and fell over each other, they shouted, "The socialists have come." In the midst of the mayhem, a bulb exploded, and the shouts mutated to, "The Chinese have started bombing." Once peace was restored, the Amir resumed his address, but to a much smaller audience. A hopeless Amir stared at his crowd and said, "If the cows also turn socialists, what is there to do?" So the mirth and relish with which the socialist cows event was reported in the Daily Shongbad was most likely done to highlight the silliness of the situation, and perhaps in particular the intellectual naivety of the Jamaat-e-Islami followers. But what the article in fact draws attention to was the powerful and the palpable transformative and revolutionary political force that was coursing its way through Pakistan at that point in time. This was a politics that was trans-regional and Asiatic, but also local and subaltern. It threatened to sweep away the existing structures, institutions, and values and replace it with a world turned upside down. So over 1969-1970, at the height of the popular uprising in both wings of Pakistan that eventually toppled the long, decade-long dictatorship of Ayub Khan, the threat of China and socialism was represented in the single figure of Maulana Bashani, the Sufi peer, saint, peasant and labor organizer, and the octogenarian leader of the National Awami Party peaking in Pakistan. So this is a picture that's coming out of the Jamaat-e-Islami magazine, which shows a dancing Bashani over flames. So this paper, what this paper is going to do, it examines the genuine desire and possibility of Islamic socialism in Pakistan that emerged in the late 1960s via the politics of Maulana Bashani and the National Awami Pakistan, which I will argue gathered momentum as a result of his travels to China. So Maulana Bashani's uncanny ability and willingness to upset and unnerve the ruling establishment and those opposed to his pro-present and worker politics, his demand for greater social, economic, and political equality and leveling of power was not really something that was new. It had developed over half a century of being in the forefront of political movements from the colonial into the post-independence period. But Bashani's political activities in both wings of Pakistan in the 1960s were to strike a particular nerve with the opposition for a number of reasons. But firstly, so many people had assumed Bashani had fallen off the political map from the early 1960s. Apparently, Bashani, satisfied with the political concessions made to him and his party by Ayub regime, after he had allegedly helped broker a material economic relationship with the Chinese communists, had adopted a quietist position on domestic policy. He'd become the Maulana, but with none of the menace and punch that the title assumed. In 1965, the leader of the Awami League, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, accused Bashani of being a Razakar. He called him a collaborator. Yet on December 1968, when Ayub arrived in East Pakistan, assured that he had taken care of the main sources of agitation in the province, with Sheikh Mujibur Rahman in jail standing trial for conspiracy, and with schools and universities closed, the trouble came for Ayub from more unexpected quarters. The response to Bashani's call for a province-wide hartal, a strike, and a public disobedience from peasants, workers, students, and others was an overwhelming triumph, disrupting Ayub's visit and signaling the first phase of the uprising in East Pakistan, which was to go on till March 1969 and thereafter. It appears that Bashani was not as politically inactive or weak as his opponents had assumed. Second, Bashani's mobilization of peasants and workers in both wings of Pakistan had a more radical and militant character over this period, with demands for workers and peasants to giral, to surround, Pural and Jalal, burn factories and farms. In East Pakistan, from the middle of February 1969, there was escalation of news on violent and gruesome decapitation and deaths of thieves, mahajans, moneylenders, village chairmen and landlords in North Bengal. A desperate Ayub, just weeks before resigning, wrote in his diary in March, gangs, quote, gangs of communists and terrorists on the prompting of Bashani are raiding police stations, the houses and properties of Muslim leaguers and asking the chairman and members of the Basic Democrats to resign. In consequence, most of the civil officers have left their posts, and so have the local rent collectors, and their records have been burnt, end quote. In the West Wing, Bashani, quoting Allama Iqbal, told peasants and workers to burn the land that did not feed them, to seize mills and factories if a livable minimum wage was not provided, and boycott elections if they did not receive a proportional share of seats in the political assemblies. Although it's not possible to draw, these are some of the images that were appearing from this period in time and reporting from magazines. So it's not possible to draw a direct relationship between Bashani's activity and the militancy of protesters, but Bashani's forthright call for more systematic and radical overhaul of structures and relationships of power was matched by organized, if not a slightly an enthusiastic, if not a slightly murderous response by peasants and workers in Pakistan. Bashani's politics also had a more defined objective during this period, the establishment of Islamic socialism. Over 1969-70, Bashani centered this demand in all of his political addresses in both wings. On 23rd to 25th of March 1970, Nat Bashani organized the Toba Tek Singh Conference in Punjab. This was one of the largest and significant gatherings of peasants, workers, students, intellectual, poets, writers, artists, and left activists and workers in the history of Pakistan. Maulana Bashani, the chief guest, informed his gatherings that Islamic socialism was the solution to the economic, social, and political sufferings of people. He framed land redistribution and nationalization of industries as key features of this project of Islamic socialism, on the basis that God was the owner of everything in the world. He demanded a popular referendum and threatened guerrilla war if it did not happen. Bashani's calls for Islamic socialism became more insistent in the peasant conferences that he held in East Pakistan, in places like Santosh and Mahipur, which are regions in the North Bengal region of East Pakistan, where the processions were more visibly and aesthetically socialist, with attendees wearing red caps, scarves, badges, waving red flags, and bamboo sticks. Bashani's opponents, often derisive of his politics as being without substance, whimsical, or plain rabble-rousing, mainly because of the spaces and constituencies within which he operated in, could not dismiss his politics so casually this period. Humaira Iqtidar notes the shifts in the writing of Maulana Sayyid Abul Ala Maududi, the Jamaat-e-Islami leader, which prior to the 1960s were focused on Islam's relationship to the West, colonialism, and modernity. But the popular response to Bashani and Bhutto's Islamic socialism at home and the realization that Jamaat-e-Islami were losing the Islamic discourse to the left compels Maududi to construct a critique of Islamic socialism. The Yawm-e-Shaukat Islam rallies, translated as the Glory of Islam rallies, organized by the Jamaat-e-Islami as a direct response to the Toba Tek Singh Conference, had as its main slogan, death to socialism. So why was Bashani's Islamic socialism so threatening? Bashani's ability to connect his local politics to wider, dynamic, and insurgent geographies communities, ideas, and politics magnified his power. It was this double character in Bashani's Islamic socialism that threatened the Pakistan regime, who could not dismiss this ideal, this politics, as a foreign, alien, or imported idea, or a narrower and provincial form of politics. So how does Bashani come to develop his ideas of Islamic socialism? So there's an influence of Bashani's doing all these earlier trips to Europe, Egypt, and Syria, in Syria in the early to mid-1950s, and you see this stance on anti-imperialist politics, which is kind of visible in his demands for a non-aligned and independent foreign policy, nuclear disarmament, and world peace. But the trip to China, in his own words, had a profoundly transformative effect on him. He described it as a religious experience. In Mao Zedong's Deshe, the only text that Bashani is known to have ever written, he describes his trip as a defiant and incomparable experience, akin to going to Mecca itself. In the preface, he wrote, quote, "Lots of my friends were hurt by my travel to China. They would have been happy if I'd gone to the US instead. Had I refused the invite, they would have garlanded me. They would have even garlanded me. I have friends like this. I knew what they were all thinking, but still I went to China. In a conflict-ridden world, China is a huge marvel. In Asia, Africa, and Latin America, they are the leaders of the liberation struggle of the oppressed. China has established itself in those three continents as the beacon of people's freedom. I went to visit that holy place. I did not fail in seeing it. After having experienced the rhythms of this new world, I have learned to see the scattered 80 years of life, of my life, in a new way. There is no shame in my mind," end quote. Bashani's trip to China in October 1963 to attend the 24th anniversary celebrations, and again in August 1964 to participate in the People's Rally supporting Vietnam against US armed aggression, can be read as part of the Cold War diplomacy, and Bashani as a mere pawn to larger interests. In the 1960s, Pakistan, worried about being cold-shouldered by the US, searched for new allies, and none appeared more suitable to China, especially after the 1962 war with India, common enemy. Pakistan was also drawn to the possibility that an informal alliance with China might put pressure on the US and Soviet Union to reconsider their positions on Kashmir. China also sought to build new alliances with Pakistan after their breakup with the Soviet Union in the early 60s, and their new emphasis on the Afro-Asian world as the epicenter of world revolution. Notwithstanding the fact that Bashani's insights were partially dictated by what Chinese officials wanted him to see, his interpretations are still important and revealing. Bashani, who'd by then engaged in political life for almost 40 years, was a shrewd political operator and knew how to get what he wanted. So what new world did Bashani see? What futures did he imagine during this trip? So Bashani's book, a rich and ethnographic account of his trip to China, and the memoirs and photos of Farooq Ahmed Chaudhry, who was a diplomatic official for Pakistan in this period, offer some insight to what their new world looked like. So there's Mao at the center, and there's Bashani with his cap at the far right. So what is this new world that Bashani sees? It's an anti-hierarchical, anti-imperialist, and radically egalitarian Afro-Asian socialist world, full of happy, dignified peasants and workers elevated to positions of prominence. On the 29th of September, Bashani, head of the Pakistani delegation, arrives by air to Peking to celebrate 14th National Day celebrations. His is one of 80 delegations coming from countries such as Afghanistan, Albania, Algeria, Brazil, Cambodia, Cuba, Japan, Korea, Mexico, Nigeria, Uruguay, and many others. Bashani is royally welcomed at the airport, landing by Vice Premier Chen Yi and other members. Over the next few days, Bashani mingled and conversed with the other 1,800 to 2,000 foreign guests at the various sort of lavish receptions and dinners organized by state officials. So you have October the 1st, the main day of the celebrations. You have Tiananmen Square, The stage of the National Day celebrations bedecked with banners, streamers, outsized red lanterns, thronged with gaily dressed people carrying flowers, flags, making for a gay and colorful scene. On the central rostrum, you have Mao, you have Chen Yi, you have Liu Shaoqi, you have Chao Enlai. But they're joined by selected foreign guests, which included M.H. Lukman and Dian Adik. These were the senior leaders of the Communist Party of Indonesia who were later purged, who were later killed in the 1965 purge. Then you have Robert Franklin Williams, the civil rights activist, writer of Negroes with Guns, the founding text of the Black Panther Party. And you have Omar Ozegan, the Algerian Minister of Agricultural Reform, and Maulana Bashani himself. From the rostrum, Bashani saw huge statues of Marx and sort of Engels, Stalin, Lenin. You have models of new machines, fruits, vegetables, farm animals, sheaves of newly harvested grains, parades of engineers, scientists, educationists, militiamen, and members of China's minority communities. You have big paintings that showed, quote, people of all races joined arms in a common struggle against colonialism and imperialism, end quote, and paraders shouting, workers of an oppressed peoples and nations unite, and we stand four square behind the American Negro people and the struggle against racial discrimination. So these celebrations, in some ways, similarly extravagant as previous years, but there's a noticeably smaller European contingent, and there's a more marked participation of Afro-Asian socialists. So what did it mean for Bashani to be part of this gathering of leaders watching the procession go by? And I'm going to say that this celebration was as much as about brown and black socialism as it was about Chinese communism. Bashani got a glimpse of what an Afro-Asian socialist world could look like and the grounds on which alliances and solidarities could be built amongst people who've undergone common struggles of colonialism, imperialist exploitation and oppression. Although it's not been possible to trace the conversations or relationships that Bashani developed with people like Dian Adik, Robert Williams and other attendees, we can, to a limited extent, imagine some of the possible conversations sparked between these encounters. Let us take Amer Ozegan, who came from a family of Berber peasants, was a member of the Algerian Communist Party, expelled in 1945, then worked for the National Liberation Front. In 1962, he published Le Milieu Combat. I'm sorry, I'm going to kill this, my French, so in other words, the better struggle. And in this book, what Ozegan is doing is advocating the fusion of Islamic and socialist thinking. Or in Ozegan's word, what he's looking for is a synthesis between Islam and socialism, where he is pushing the contradictions to the bottom. Bashani must have also found a lot in common with Robert Franklin Williams, by then a fugitive, an FBI fugitive, and in Cuba in exile. In many ways similar to Bashani, Robert Franklin Williams is described as a difficult man who cannot adjust himself to loving his enemies, and it's almost always vituperous and undiplomatic towards his political rulers. Williams had also published his book in 1962, Negroes with Guns, where he's demanding black militancy in the civil rights struggle in contrast to Martin Luther King. Bashani's encounter with socialists of all hues must have made apparent to him the possibilities of inhabiting multiple identities, of being militantly black, proud, being a Muslim and socialist. And he must have, similar, like Robert Franklin Williams, seen the need for flexibility in the freedom struggle, the flexibility to creatively work through images and the politics of the future. The other thing that Bashani does in his book is he sketches these encounters with an anti-hierarchical and anti-authority and radical egalitarian world where everyone has access to health, education, low rent housing, and employment opportunities. Each livelihood has a dignity of its own and positions based on skill and hard work. Now, the embodiment of this new world was symbolized in Bashani's meeting with Puyi, the last emperor of China, and the then administrator at Beijing Botanical Gardens. Bashani discussed with Puyi for 4.5 hours about his transition from an out-of-touch emperor colluding with the Japanese to repentant, committed, and a humble socialist and worker. Puyi, when asked by Bashani about his life as a ruler, stated, quote, "You want to know about my life as a ruler? There's not much to tell. Those were the most wretched, the most unfortunate days of my life, filled with memories of my offenses against humanity. But today I can say with pride, I can say with joy that I'm a changed human being, that I have become a true citizen of China. This reform life is a life of happiness. The earlier life was like a ghostly existence, darkened by the curses of phantom souls." Emperor. So Bashani, you know, is familiar with stories of just and benevolent Mughal emperors and rulers who feature in many Islamic fables and akhlaqi ethical texts. But these rulers were still quite unlike Bashani's real-life encounter with the emperor-turned-socialist and the redemptive powers of a homegrown socialism. And this most likely shapes his ideas on the possibilities of power and authority. Lastly, what we see is Bashani. So what it's Bashani's interactions and observations of a dynamic rural communism in China that left the most powerful and lasting impression here. As Bashani toured communes across China, he described how he found himself fascinated by the hashi, the laughter of the Chinese peasants. Bashani, the long-standing leader of peasants, constituencies whose lives had not really seen any improvement from the transition from the colonial to the post-colonial period, was struck by the success of people's communes, in particular the dignity and self-respect that peasants appear to acquire through it. Bashani, though partially aware of the failure of people's communes at that point, was nonetheless impressed by the self-directed activity of Chinese peasants and the centrality and prominence afforded to rural life in communist China. Bashani wrote, quote, I saw the widespread change that an awakened and creative labor force freed from oppression can bring to the life of a village. In fact, not just in the lives of the village people, because the commune system is of immeasurable importance to the entire economy in people's China. If I did not see this unique meeting of labor and happiness with my own eyes, my visit to China would have been left incomplete. End quote. So Bashani ended his book on China on the same note that he had started it, a transformed man. He had, in accordance with the sayings of the prophet, gone as far as China in his quest for knowledge, and there he had found the victory of the people. So, you know, he comes back from China, and what we see, as I've mentioned earlier, a sort of what appears to be a retreat from public visibility. Despite being one of the key supporters of the opposition candidate, Fatima Jinnah, in 1965 presidential election against Ayub Khan, Bashani apparently loses his enthusiasm halfway into the campaign and enters into a period of political quietude after Ayub's triumph. However, contrary to those impressions of Bashani as a politically passive figure to the Ayub regime, a different archive indicates that Bashani was stealthily organizing and mobilizing the peasantry of North Bengal as well as sort of labor constituencies everywhere. So what we see Bashani doing is that he's drawing upon his sort of observations of this variegated Afro-Asian socialism, anti-hierarchical and egalitarian practices, and dynamic rural communism that he'd seen in China, and he applies it to his everyday relationship and practices with peasants and workers as their religious saint and leader. So he engages in several innovative practices that were intended to organize and mobilize his constituents groups to bring about a form of Islamic socialism, or at least to prepare the way for it. Islamic socialism was held as the antithesis to imperialist depredations, which Bashani and the National Awami Party identified as one of the key obstacles to Pakistan's freedom and sovereignty. Unlike the six-point program put forward by the Awami League, which sought greater freedom for the Bengali populace at large, Bashani offered the peasants and workers a model that primarily spoke to the material and spiritual emancipation, made them central to its realization. So how does he do this? He does this first through the brokering, through the introduction of new sort of relationships and linkages. And he brokers one of the most unlikely relationships between Bashani's murids, his disciples, the Marxist workers of National Awami Party, the Krishok Shamiti, the Peasants Association, and the Mazdoor Federation, the Workers Association, legitimating the existence of the other in one another's worlds. And this is done through the modification, if not complete innovation, that Bashani introduced in his relationship with murids, particularly in the buyer, the oath of allegiance over this period. So what is the buyer? So Niall Green describes the buyer, administered over centuries through a hand clasp or written declaration or by touching the peer's unraveled turban, as the gatekeeping ritual of initiation. Once the rules set by the Sufi master has been accepted, the disciple is formally initiated into the brotherhood and given access to the master's special knowledge of God. So keeping with tradition, Bashani offered his murids his own distinctive brand of drawing closer to God. The baya now is printed in a check-like format with a counterfoil of the murid's oath alongside his signature. And what you see in the script is, alongside the usual articles of belief in God, the prophet, and the spiritual lineage, what's demanded from the peasants is a belief in socialism. So the buyer stated, there is only one path to the freedom of all people from all forms of oppression, socialism. And I will, till my last breath, work to establish it. I will participate in the volunteer corps of the Krishok Shamiti to eradicate the foundations of capitalism, feudalism, bribery, corruption, and all other socialist ills from the country. The buyer makes a Marxist out of the murid and a murid out of the Marxist. So with the Marxist workers of NAP and the Krishok Shamiti more frequently present at religious gatherings and mosques, the murid was to find his world equally transformed during this period. With belief in socialism now naturalized into an article of faith, what you see is that the murid's search for that deeper connection with Bashani and God was to be found in his engagement with the external world of political activism, as well as much as the internal world of dhikr, chants, and muraqabah, meditation. So Burhanuddin, who's on the left here, a murid and peasant cultivator from Tangail in the North Bengal, in the course of performing his spiritual duties, did not only become a firm advocate of anti-imperialism, but was also arrested over 5 times for his Krishok Shamiti activities. These peasants, whether recruited as murids or by Marxist workers, were to find their different pledges had an equal bind, both in terms of content and form. It was no coincidence that the buyer resembled the subscription form of this Krishok Shamiti. The representation of the buyer in this very modern and secular form was intended to give it the same weight of authority that other paper transactions had come to acquire in the life of the peasant, the rent receipt from the state or the jothedar, or the loan receipts from the local mahajan or the jothedar. In the same way that Bashani said that the peasant who paid to become a member of the Krishok Shamiti would remember it for the rest of his life because of its effect on his material existence, the buyer was intended to have a similar association, if not a stronger one. Amongst the few written documents that a peasant was to accumulate in his life, the buyer now stood as a reminder of what was needed for a freer and more fulfilling spiritual and material existence. In 1963, Bashani announced that the Krishok Shamiti had already enrolled 100,000 East Pakistani peasants with ultimate aim of reaching 2 million members. I'm never sure whether they make it to 2 million members, but I did see a checkbook of 200 receipts, and over 60,000 of those were printed. We have no idea what's happened to them, but there were a lot of members recruited through the buyer. So the second intervention that Bashani does is equally interesting, and it's his introduction of new ideas, languages, and vocabularies in assemblies and gatherings intended to impart to the peasants and workers a sense of their own power and dynamism. Bashani introduced his constituents to their new selves over this period. They were the Shorbahara, the have-nots. Now, the Shorbahara itself is not a new word, right? It's regularly used in the Marxist lexicon to refer to the proletariat class. But Bashani, what he does here is that he opens it to incorporate wider and different histories, futures, and icons, both sacred and profane. The Shorbahara, for him, constituted a class that was not defined by what it lacked, but by their ubiquitous presence across different times, geographies, and civilizations, possessing the power to change the course of history. So Bashani, in a speech in 1964 in Pubna, clearly defined who the Shorbahara were. Theirs was a rich lineage, he said, from the Bani Israelis in ancient Egypt to the followers of Prophet Saleh in the land of Thamud, people who had battled the, quote, class of big people who had appropriated Arable land and conspired to take people's livelihood from them, end quote. But it was not just in religious time that the Shorbahara were to be found. They were the Sicilian slaves. According to him, they were the Sicilian slaves who had revolted against the Roman Empire and the Russian, European, and Asian peasants and workers of the modern age. Their more immediate ancestors, he said, were the ones who had fought against the Hindu zamindars and Muslim badshahs in the Wahhabi, Farezi, Indigo, Nankar, and Tebaga movements. As he concluded his history lesson, Bashani explained the value of it to the peasants. Quote, "You are not weak as you think you are. Actually, you're not weak at all. In the face of your united strength, any government, however powerful it is obliged to bow its head." End quote. The Shorbahara found their own champions and heroes contained within these narratives, as varied as Mao and Abu Zar al-Ghifari, a companion of the Prophet, and someone strikingly more important and Shia than Sunni historiographies. Abu Zar was described as a non-conformist for his banishment by the fourth Caliph Uthman due to his outspoken attack on for the misuse of public funds and the maldistribution of wealth. And Abu Zar al-Ghifari acquires special attention in Bashani's account, who saw in the defiance of Abu Zar a sanction for peasants and workers to resist their Muslim rulers, but also the state itself on issues of injustice and oppression. So what we see on 30th November 1967 at the National sort of Awami Party Special Convention in Rangpur, Bashani's emphasis on the role that the Shorbahara were to play splinters this already strained party. He says, "I firmly believe that the only group that can provide anti-imperialist and democratic leadership successfully is the Shorbahara class, no other class. NAP is the only party that has accepted the program for the freedom of peasants and workers, that is the hardworking Shorbahara class. NAP cannot nullify its program and be the tail of the program of another party." So when a slighted Qazi Mohiuddin declared NAP to be the Shorbahara party with a Shorbahara program, holding little value for any others, what he intended his words to be was to, a recognition of why he resigned from Bashani's NAP to form the pro-Moscow NAP. Well, what this resignation actually signals is that Bashani has succeeded, at least in his own rhetoric, to project the peasants and workers as constituting a well-defined and powerful class who are capable of representing their interests and prepared to play an instrumental, if not leading, role to bring about fundamental changes to state and society. So the British certainly seem to think that Ayub Khan had got it wrong when he described the Awami League as extremists in 1967. The High Commissioner wrote the true extremists so far in East Pakistan are the National Awami Party. It is NAP which really aims to be the party of protest. So let me now move to the conclusion. The figure of Maulana Bashani, what it does is that it tells this lost story of Islamic socialism in South Asia, which has been submerged in the histories of making and unmaking nations. The historiography on Islamic socialism continues to be, in the context of South Asia, continues to be small and a relatively under-researched one compared to its counterparts in the Middle East and Southeast Asia. The focus has been overwhelmingly on the figures and politics that emerged during the 1918 to 1922 Khilafat movement. Humayun Ahmad's pioneering work on early Muslim socialists show how they emerged out of the transnational convergence of pan-Islamism, Indian anti-colonial nationalism, and Bolshevism. But Islamic socialism has been treated as a political project that diminished with the collapse of the Khilafat movement, morphing into either these secular individual projects or absorbed into religious political projects. And ultimately, the idea of Islamic socialism is suppressed after independence. Additionally, Islamic socialism has been treated as an intellectual project where members of ulama debated on property ownership, land redistribution, and Islamic economics, according to the Quran and Hadith. Qasim Zaman treats the grassroots activism of members of the ulama, such as Ubaidullah Sindhi and Maulana Popalzai, as being of less importance than their writings on economic justice. And what happens is that you have scholars of the left working on Marxist left politics in the Afro-Asian world, and though conscious of the heterogeneous forms of global Marxism, they've nonetheless focused on the agonistic politics between left and Islam, and the vexed question of whether Muslims were ill-suited to Marxism or Marxism ill-suited to Muslim society. Recent scholarship by Humaira Iqtidar, James Karen, Manfred Singh indicate a shift in the scholarly treatment of Islamic socialism, with the popular dimensions of Islam emerging as an important factor for understanding how South Asian Muslims have thought about internationalism, socio-economic justice, and progressive politics. Here I find Manfred Singh's approach to the categories of Islam and Marxism as, quote, ambivalent systems of thought open to divergent interpretations that can converge, or partially intersect and fundamentally clash with each other, as useful to understanding how Marxism became part of a mystical and effective and non-secular episteme. So Bashani's travel to China in the 1960s, a counterpoint to earlier directions of Sufi movements, shows us how religion and peasant internationalism came together in the inter-Asian world, in this inter-Asian context, to produce a third world project of Islamic socialism. Bashani's visit to China and Islamic socialism points to an internationalism from below, rooted in peasant and working class life and labor. Ideas of anti-imperialism, socialism, Afro-Asian solidarity and cooperation. So far, what we've seen in discussions of, of sort of Afro-Asian encounters have appeared to be in some ways soul preserved of elites and their travels and what they produce in terms of text. But what we see here is that they emanated from, and these ideas were desired by subaltern classes who made it part of their political practice. So what remains of this project of third world internationalism? Bashani is dead. The nation state is resilient and brutal, and ancient Asiatic encounters have changed. But the dream, so to quote sort of Walter Benjamin, what he uses to discuss the sort of revolutionary possibilities of the present, he uses this idea of the dream images of that particular epoch. The dream images of that particular epoch can still be found. And they're in the huts and homes of poor villagers and charred dwellers in Bangladesh, Assam, and Pakistan, who dream of Bashani flying on boats pulled by tigers to visit them in their dreams and to talk about the next protest. He's also present in political protests against power plants, river erosions, or against the NRC, the National Register of Citizens, in Assam. He's present in left circles and working class Muslim diasporas who are looking for their Desi Malcolm X or their Muslim Ambedkar. They're also present in clandestine archives. Clandestine archives, when I say clandestine archives, I mean special branches of the official archives, who despite their best efforts cannot erase that material as quick as they would like to. These are the spaces where the spectre of third world internationalism lingers. Thank you very much.